One, thank you for inviting me, first of all, and of course my Dharma brother, Carl. You know, when I came to Zen practice, initially, I had some very essential questions that I needed to answer. Who am I really? What's the meaning of this life? You know, what's it really all about? Why am I here? What's the truth? What's reality? Some of those questions came up for me not directly through a spiritual practice, but actually through psychology. But they still took me to the same intersection of asking those kind of questions. What's it really all about? Is it really just getting Fios? You know, I mean, what or a new car? So often I was very lucky, you know, because I've happened to stumble onto a teacher who kept turning those questions back to me, which was very important. And so anyway, I found a nice little story about this that I just wanted to kind of share with you. It's a story about two Dharma brothers. I think of the Blues Brothers, you know, the Dharma Brothers. Only these guys were called, one was called Shui Feng, and his very good friend, whose name was Yen Tu. They were at a monastery, and as would happen in China, they would go on pilgrimage periodically. They would get permission to leave the monastery and go on pilgrimage, and they were traveling together, came to a place that was called Tortoise Mountain, a village near Tortoise Mountain. And they got snowed in. It was a huge snowstorm there. They were snowed in for days in this little hut. Again, it was normal for the folks in those times to, on pilgrimage, find a hermitage and to stay there to practice. Well, you can imagine that in a little hut, there's not a whole lot to do. These are little huts. Yen Tu, who was the younger, slept all day. Shui Feng was doing zazen all day. So periodically, Yen Tu would wake up, you know, roll over on his straw mat, open up his eye, and what would he see? His Dharma brother, Shui Feng, sitting in zazen. He'd go back to sleep. A few hours later, he'd wake up, open up his eye. There's his friend, Shui Feng, sitting in zazen. This went on for a couple of days. Eventually, Yen Tu, when he woke up, said to his friend, "What are you doing sitting here all day in zazen like a stone Buddha? What are you doing?" Shui Feng said, "Well, my heart is not at peace these days." Now, this statement alone is an important one, actually. I think it's one of the first teachings in this story. I was doing a sesshin out in Houston, Texas. We have a small community out there, and I go out there twice a year, and we usually, at the end of a sesshin, we do a practice circle. Some of you may have done practice circles, but we did a circle, and one of the people who were there, her first sesshins, was saying in the practice circle that she was very disappointed in how the sesshin had gone for her because she had recognized just how active her mind was. And she was aware of how much thinking that she did. And she saw this as a negative thing, but I saw it as a positive thing. It's a great step in practice, one's practice, when you start to have more of an awareness of what your mind is doing, what's happening with you, what you're experiencing. To have a recognition that your heart is not at rest is not a small thing. And for her to have her awareness of the narrative that she constantly told herself, about her life, was not a small thing. That recognition is important, and it's a big step in one's practice to see that. It means that you're developing some sense of consciousness and awareness to observe what is actually happening with you. That's important. So he says, "My heart is not at peace Yentu says, well, if you'd like, if I have, with your permission, maybe I can help you. This is another good teaching in this koan. We should be asking permission before we just launch in to tell somebody what they should do, or how they should do it, or when they should do it, or the proper way to do it, or what the right way is to do it. We should actually ask whether they would like our assistance or not, because sometimes you unilaterally offering your ideas serves you a lot more than it serves someone else. It inflates us. It serves us. Nice to ask first, because somebody may say, no, thank you. I'm trying to find my own way with this. And you leave them alone. Even if they stumble, you might leave them alone. Let them stumble. I remember my own teacher, Roshi Kennedy, saying, disappointment was the greatest chariot. It's his style, you know. That usually when we hit something, hit a wall, or are disappointed, it can become a door for us to learn something and to grow. So I thought this was another wonderful teaching in this koan. He asked permission. That's a beautiful respect, actually, for someone on a spiritual path. You know? Well, his friend Shui Feng says, yes, of course, I would like your help. He says, when I first started to study with my first teacher, whose name was Yen Quan, he told me about the meaning of form and emptiness, and I gained some understanding. Yen Tu says, don't mention this again for 30 years. Shui Feng nods. He says, then I read about the great teacher Tong Shan and his verse about being enlightened when he saw his reflection in a river. I had an insight then. Hien Tu says, if you go on like this, you won't be able to save yourself at all. Shui Feng nodded and said, and then I studied with my last teacher, Taishan. I said to him, do I have any capacity to be enlightened? Do I have any connection with the teachings and the teachers of the past? Taishan gave out a great shout, what are you saying? And he hit me. And when he hit me, it was like a bottom falling out of a bucket. I had another insight. Shui Yang Tu yelled out, haven't you heard it said that what comes in through the gate is not the family treasure? It must flow out of your own heart, and then it will cover heaven and earth. Then you will have some real, small glimpse of a realization. I was struck by his statement. Haven't you heard it said that what comes in through the gate is not the family treasure? It must flow out from your own heart and cover heaven and earth. Then Shui Feng had a great insight. He bowed to his friend and he said, my dear brother, today I, the whole village of Tortoise Mountain, in fact, this whole mountain and this whole world have attained the way. Interesting. When I read about this, it became clear to me that our work in spiritual practice is based more about what is inside of us than what comes in from the outside. Don't you know that the true family treasure doesn't come in through the gate? It doesn't come from the outside. No matter how beautiful, no matter how elegant the words or the sayings, it may not be you, may not be your own insight. There's somebody else's. Usually the world gives us an awful lot of opportunities to take more of what comes from the outside than building an awareness of what comes from the inside. Part of this is about our desires, I think. Desire to be loved, desire to be accepted, desire to be successful, desire to be secure, desire to be approved of. We can shape ourselves too much by what's asked of us or expected of us from the outside, from information that is outside. And it becomes dangerous because then we start to become shapeshifters. Public faces that we put on, masks that we wear in the hope of being loved and accepted, but we lose ourselves in the process, even in Zen. How can you offer the way if you don't know who you are? If you don't know what your own way is, how can you offer it? What would you be offering? So you see, what Yen Tu offers is his true self to his friend. He's sleeping all day. That was his way. At least at that moment. You see, the Dharma and the teachings are not separate from your own experience. Now, I'm saying this, but I will also say that certainly in the very beginning of practice, when you are starting out in practice, it is very appropriate that you imitate. It's appropriate. It's helpful to imitate. You should watch your teacher. It's okay to do that. We need to do that because our teacher, we are aware that our teacher has attained something that we haven't yet seen, and we watch. I learned more from what my teacher did than what he said. See, I watched what he did because I was skeptical. So I said, okay, this guy's got some great words, but let's see how he actually lives his life. What are you actually doing? So I learned a lot more from watching to see whether his words and his actions were in some type of harmony. And of course he wasn't perfect, but I watched him practice it. I said, okay, then he's my teacher. It's also true that at some point we have to let that go. I mean, while it's helpful in the very beginning of practice to imitate our teacher, at some point we have to drop it, see, and then we have to become ourselves. We have to move towards our own style. And if you have a teacher, and I don't think you do, matter of fact, I know that you don't, but if you find a teacher who is pulling you to their style instead of honoring what yours is, then I would say run. The family treasure does not come in through the gate. So, but here is what Yen Tu's teaching is to his friend, you know. You must come out from your own heart, from your own breast, in order to cover heaven and earth with it. Sometimes that means giving up a dream. You know, we have a dream that we're going to be a certain way. But sometimes living the dream that we have to live a certain way, to be a certain way, takes us away from living our own life. Farther and farther away from it, trying to follow a dream instead of what's real. So anyway, that is to say, you know, at our Zendo, some of you have been there, I think, some of you haven't, but at our Zendo, I put outside the door, just show up, which was my way of saying, when you enter this room, you're to be yourself. Just show up as you are, with what you've got. What are the ingredients that are already part of your life? You work with those. You don't act like an ass outside the door. And when you walk through the archway, think that you're going to be spiritual in some fashion. Then I have to hit you. So when we come to the Zendo and we sit with who we actually are. That includes the difficulties that we have as well as our joys. We work with the ingredients of our life. If you're suffering or you're grieving, we try to get quiet and turn compassionately in. We turn in. You know, I think somebody asked me a while ago, what is Zen practice? I said, it's always turning towards what's right in front of you. It's turning towards it, whatever it is. So if you're suffering or grieving, you get quiet and you turn compassionately inward. You breathe into the experience that's right there in your body, in your heart, in your life. Rather than it's you seeing it as an obstacle that you have to get over so that you can be more divine. Because I think Zen practice is about a practice of becoming more human. It's not about a practice of becoming divine. It's to become a human being. A mature human being. I think the goal of Zen practice, as I've read, is a perfection of character. It's not about being godly. It's about being you. Because there's no lack inside. You're already the one. You just haven't seen it yet. So it's already in us. It's already in us. In other words, it's most important that you realize that the true teacher is inside of you. One of my favorite books is Rainier Maria Rilke's Letters to a Young Poet. If you're familiar with this, he talks about this a little bit. He says, you must realize that no one can really advise or help you. You're on your own, essentially. He's talking to a young poet who's writing him letters. You know, this young poet is looking for information and advice about becoming a poet. But I'm going to use the word Zen or spiritual practice for poetry. No one can advise or help you, no one. There is only one thing that you should do. Go into yourself. Find out the reason that commands you to practice. See whether it has spread its roots into the very depths of your own heart. Confess to yourself whether you would have to die if you were forbidden to practice. Dig into yourself for a deep answer. Don't look to someone else. And if this answer rings out in assent, if you meet the solemn question with a strong, simple, I must, I want to, then you build your life in accordance with that necessity. That's beautiful to me. Then you come a little bit closer to nature. I understand nature as a sense of truth, or you know, what's real. He's talking about writing here, and he says, so rescue yourself from the general themes that you would usually write about. Write what your everyday life offers you. Describe your sorrows and your desires, the thoughts that pass through your mind and your belief in some kind of beauty, and describe these with heartfelt, silent, humble sincerity. That's about our Zen practice as well. That's the ticket. Now, I think that in my experience, when I first of all, I think it's very normal, very common for us, because we're all conditioned to it, to want to look outside of ourselves initially, but I think it's helpful to catch ourselves. And we can gain some information from outside, there's nothing wrong with that, but we always have to ask ourselves if it's resonant with something that's inside, rather than giving away what's inside in order to think that the answer is out there. Does it resonate? Is it true for me? If not, I say don't pay any attention to it. Just like in a Teisho, in this Teisho, for example, there might just be one word that I've said or one sentence that resonates with you. Don't worry about the rest of it. Just take what fits for your next step, for your own life, and use that. So when we're able to do this, when we're able to actually make a space of honoring whatever our truth is, whether it's a joy or a grief or a suffering or a fear, we may not be ready for it, you know. But if we're able to practice to hold it, not judge it, not try to kill it, but to somehow honor it, then our ability grows in terms of how to be compassionate with ourselves. If I'm able to stay present to my own suffering, or present to my grief, or present to my fear, then it will begin to transform because of the relationship that we're cultivating with it. We cultivate a relationship of love and joy with our fear, to want to learn from what our fear has to teach us, then the fear will change. There will become, I'm telling you, a great spaciousness that will start to happen inside of you. I call it a field of belonging. There's a sense of belonging. There's a field that we will experience in which can hold us and our fear. It can hold us and our joy. And when we can make peace with that inside, there's a spaciousness that opens up that you can stand in that place. You don't have to run. You don't have to get drunk. You don't have to hide. You're at home. And when we're at home in our joy, as well as being at home in our grief, not only are we more peaceful and compassionate, but we're able to be more compassionate to others in their grief, because we know what it's like and we can stand there. We can look them in the eye and extend a hand to them, because we know what it's like, because we can hang out there. This is the first vow. Creations are numberless. I vow to save them. When we are able to save ourselves, we're able to save all others, because we know inside what it's about. Now, I talk about joy and suffering, or joy and pain, because in my experience anyway, it's just as hard to hang out with your joy as it is with your sorrow, because a lot of people believe they don't deserve that. Mm-hmm. Me, I'm too joyful. No, I don't deserve that, no. Mm-mm, can't hang out there. Sometimes that's just as hard, to be able to be with what's beautiful about us as well as what's uncomfortable in us. So if we're able to understand that the treasure does not come in through the family gate but is already inside of us, then we are much more free. We can make this spacious field for our grief and our happiness. We find joy in what's already present, and even when difficulties arrive, we use those difficulties as ingredients for our growth. And then whatever it is that we experience in our life, whether it's easy or difficult, it becomes mulch. See? Becomes the mulch for our growth. Becomes the weeds that you, after you cut them, you put them in the soil underneath the flowers, which help the flowers to bloom. See? Am I saying anything to you? You shouldn't just be sitting on your cushion dazing out. It should be, as Carl said to me once actually, like sitting on the top of a 100-foot cliff on the edge. On the edge. If you waver, you may fall. Stay alert. Thank you. Thank you. Thanks. Thank you.